Hello and welcome to this podcast of Renew Lehigh Valley's Brown Bag Discussion Series. I'm Stephen Bliss, Executive Director of Renew Lehigh Valley, and this is the recording of our August 2010 Brown Bag Session. These Brown Bags are an ongoing series of informal sessions on issues related to urban revitalization, smart growth, and regional collaboration. This session looked at the system of municipal finance in Pennsylvania, in particular, the state policies governing how local communities raise revenue and provide for essential services, and the unique challenges that the system presents for Pennsylvania's older core communities. Our featured speaker for this session was Jerry Cross. Jerry is Executive Director of the Central Division of the Pennsylvania Economy League and is an authority on local and regional governance and finance in Pennsylvania. This session was held on Friday, August 27th, 2010, at the new Segal Museum in downtown Easton. We welcome your feedback and input, so send your comments to us at smartgrowth@renewlv.org. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm sure everyone can hear me without the microphone, but we're recording it, and I promised Beta we would use it. So if I wander away from it, I apologize. Thanks for coming here. It's a real tough room. I'm getting nervous. I see experts here that the mayors, former government officials that I know, that really understand this on a day-to-day level. We have the chairman of the local government finance committee here. I have built-in fact checkers all of a sudden for my presentation. However, I was one of the things we don't emphasize in my resume that we hand out of the short bio is that I was in business for many years. I worked for the Economy League part-time when I had to have an income and my partners in business did not. I had children. But the thing that never left me was the pressure of payroll, the pressure of making ends meet. Government never really had that problem for a long time. It was self-sustaining. It was service provided. Income came in the last 20, 25 years, and I think we'll try to see this in our slides, why the structure has caused this to change. Municipal officials now spend most of their time making it to next payroll. They're optimistic about next week's payroll, very pessimistic about the following one. And that's just not a way to guarantee citizens public services when you've gotten yourself into a situation where you don't have resources available. So I'm familiar with that part of it, but the local government side also is a function of a few other things that aren't under the control of local government officials. One of the things the Economy League has done is we've done a lot of work in the Lehigh Valley over the last 40 years, both from a merger and consolidation point of view, both from the private sector side on the Chamber of Commerce's merger, the attempt at things that they were doing. But we've also been involved heavily on a local government level with school district mergers. None happened here, but school district enrollments as the consolidation efforts were going through in the 60s. We maintain a large presence as far as enrollment projections in Lehigh Valley. So we know the Lehigh Valley in and out, even though we're 50 miles away. The talk that we're having today, and I only have 12 slides, and I'd like to encourage a dialogue at the end of the slides, really is a product of two studies that the Economy League did self-funded, which culminated in a third study that was funded by the state and by the a group we call the Five Cities. The first study set out to prove, and this was in 2004, that there was something going on in local government. My experience in local government goes back to 1977 on the west shore of Harrisburg, and you had trouble making ends meet, but it was a matter of, you know, little economies here, little economies there, and the last resort was raising taxes. And it seemed, in my view and views of other local government practitioners, that things have changed in the last 20, 25 years as far as how local government is financed. We did some investigation. We compared the 1970 data with the 2003 data, which at that time was hard to do because 1970 data doesn't exist to readily use on computers. It took a lot of man hour to enter the statewide data. It was called Structuring Healthy Communities Part 1. It came up with some novel approaches, but it laid the ground with Brookings that there's a systemic problem in the way we deliver and finance local government services. It was kind of revolutionary at the time because most people still cling to the idea that your local elected officials are able to provide something to you, and it's their competence or lack thereof that determines how good the local government is. We followed that study up with Structuring Healthy Communities Part 2, which tried to show the change in revenue by category and expenditure. That's part of our slides today. But most importantly, we were asked by the mayor of Reading in 2007 to look at the financial health of five cities that have very competent professional management who find themselves in very similar straits because they've talked to each other, and the citizens think the problems are local, and when you look across the board, you realize it's a very systemic problem. Those cities were Easton, Bethlehem, Lancaster, York, and Reading. We did a study for the five showing the trend in the last 7 years in how they paid for their services. And the disturbing part of the study was most of the towns don't bring in enough money from their tax base, and the cities are forced to tap one-time revenues. And as we all know, one-time revenues do not last past one time. And it seems to us the five-city study was a small model for what's really happening in Pennsylvania. We're mortgaging today's services on debt for tomorrow. The banking crisis has effectively reduced the availability of debt for small towns, and we think you're going to see a basic threat to the entire local government's financing system that will rely more on taxes or service consolidation or service reductions. So it's a challenging time in local government, and that's why we use the title, The Challenge of Sustaining Your Local Government. Bear with me as I work with my notes here. I want to, Bay, would you give me a new slide? First, we look at the sources of revenue, and this is a surprising slide to most people. Most people, when you ask them, how do you pay for local government services, they will tell you taxes. Taxes pay for it, and I hate my property taxes. I don't really understand my earned income tax, but taxes surely pay for everything. And for one thing, the local government has to rely on it, and if they waste it, it's my money. This is the 2006 data from the state, all municipalities in the Commonwealth. When you break down the classifications, is everyone here familiar with the classifications of local government? There's cities, there's boroughs, smaller cities built on railroad spurs and transportation areas. Then there's townships of the first class, which have denser populations, except in Lower Macungie, and second-class townships, which are the... Oh, how many? Well, you're peeking ahead. There's 2,500 plus municipalities, and there's lots. Second class townships, there's 1,400, okay, which is extremely rural. A lot of them cover a lot of land area. In Pennsylvania, yeah. Well, there's 56 cities, 906 boroughs, and 91 first class townships. You're peeking ahead. That's okay. But in a sense, the numbers are irrelevant if they're all in the same boat. You know, it's just the patches you're manifesting. What we're looking at here is in the cities, taxes are less than 31% or so. That's surprising if you're thinking about a business, a city as an enterprise delivering services. Boroughs, very much similar. First-class townships, they're still fairly balanced, 50-50, and the second-class townships rely on other sources of revenue less than taxes. Hence the idea that a lot of people move to the second-class townships because their taxes are lower. In fact, they are. Now, in Lehigh Valley, this is statewide. In our report that's available on our website, Lehigh Valley has its own regional section. The numbers are not significantly different from that. So this is representative also of Lehigh Valley. Now, by proportion, tax revenue, while it's 50% in townships and smaller and boroughs and cities, has its own mix of sources for the municipalities that raise money. Most people are very familiar with real estate and to a certain extent earned income because that comes out of your paycheck. There's also a tax called real estate transfer. If you've ever bought and sold property, at closing they assign a certain amount of money to the different municipals based on the cost, and it's a percentage of the property's value. And there's also taxes based on where you work, which is called the local services tax, used to be occupational tax, and a few other taxes, per capita tax, things you may pick up throughout the year. When you look at these taxes by proportion, you start to see where the requirements to fund the city comes from and what citizens start to realize when they think my taxes pay for everything. Look in the city. Cities are heavily reliant on real estate tax. Not so much on earned income tax, because they don't have a lot of wealthy, as a rule, a lot of wealthy citizens. That's a percentage tax on income capped at half of 1%. Notice boroughs have the same proportion. They rely on the wealth inherent in the borough, basically what was built there. They have their real estate taxes. Earned income a little bit better than the city, but still reflecting the poorer nature of our cities and our boroughs as far as earned income. First-class townships, very similar to cities and property, the reliance on the property tax. If you talk to first-class township commissioners, they will tell you they're not that unlike boroughs. They have a built-out area. They're older units of government, generally on the outskirts of cities. They generally were created because they were denser in population and they were a defensive mechanism to have the city annex them. You became a first-class township, it was harder to annex your property. So you'll see those very similar. While they're township governments, you'll see them very similar to the plight of the city and the borough. Notice second-class townships. They are living on a different revenue stream. Even though it's the same municipal financing scheme, they live on a different revenue stream. They live on higher earned income. They live on higher values of people that work there. If you're familiar with the way population patterns over the last 40 years since 1970, people have generally moved out of the denser populated areas. They've moved with their income, and they've moved farther out but continue to work in the same place. That, to me, is very telling. That tells me that the second-class townships exist in a different world right now than the denser populations. That can be seen as one of the reasons why they view the world differently. They do have a different source of revenue, much like inherited wealth versus earned wealth. It's a different world, and I don't say that lightly. Now, as part of the study, Beta cut my slides now from about 40, so I have to jump ahead. As part of the study, we also compared differences from 1970 to 2006. We adjusted the revenue from 1970 to account for inflation. We then compared that with the revenue reported by category for 2006. I'm showing you the main one here, the main two sources here, real estate taxes and income tax. Notice in the city, on an inflation-adjusted basis, this is cities across the Commonwealth, that they have lost. They actually collect less money than they have in 1970. Look at the boroughs on real estate taxes, 20%. That reflects a combination of lowered assessment growth because you have less property to develop to generate new value, and reluctance to raise property tax on people that have less income to pay for it. First-class townships do not have a large increase in real estate taxes. They're more sensitive to real estate taxes. If you remember, they're pretty high. They have a higher percentage from real estate. Second-class townships, however, have a more than double in real estate revenue. That reflects assessment growth from new development. It reflects subdivisions. It reflects, I believe, assessment growth because their tax levels aren't as high as the, as you remember the other slide, their tax levels are not as high. So assessment growth in those counties, even where counties don't reassess, you're getting new growth from development of new structures, from subdivision of larger parcels into single-family homes. Look at earned income tax. In the cities, 10% increase in real dollars in the cities since 1970. The boroughs, maybe half, 50% more, 55% more. You can see the transfer of wealth. The first-class townships look good in this one. The townships do have a wealthier population when you look at the per capita data. And second-class townships, look how high that is since 1970. In 1970, second-class townships were generally rural areas. You all remember back, I think most of us here can remember 1970. It was a situation where boroughs and cities were still the place where you lived and worked and probably shopped. And the townships, the second-class townships, were predominantly rural. That's where you went on a Sunday drive. Now, for the Lehigh Valley, I don't want to ignore my script too much. For the Lehigh Valley, we have a change. Go back to that slide, Beta. This is statewide data. It is slightly different in Lehigh Valley. The earned income tax is mostly different. The real estate tracked pretty well. In Lehigh Valley, you've gone up about, earned income has gone up about 10% statewide. In the Lehigh Valley, the cities have fallen by 18%, much more of a turnaround than what you see there. So the earned income value of cities in Lehigh Valley has fallen dramatically. The boroughs are up 55%, I think, there, and in the valley, it's 22%. So you see a severe stagnation of revenue in the Lehigh Valley in the denser population areas. First class is interesting. The first class townships, I think this may actually reflect there's only three, I think. And when this data was, it was only two first class townships. About 250% growth in earned income. So they were still, in Lehigh Valley, they're still more wealthy places, and I think that reflects their location around the city. And the second class, same as the statewide, 323% increase. So the township image in the Lehigh Valley reflects the statewide data. The cities and boroughs, much worse. And this is the challenge. If your money and your revenue is eroding and your population is growing in the denser populated areas, you have a service problem. So we try to reflect this with expenses. We pulled two of the biggest expenses that we thought were uniform across the board, plus we're also the most expensive, and plus what citizens generally think is what they expect from their town. They expect someone to arrive in a uniform to protect them when they call. Look at the change in, this isn't percentage, this is points, what the change was in the combined expenditure proportion for taxes, for police and administration. We added them together. Fire, you can't compare. It's really difficult to compare fire because you have the cities with generally paid professional fire departments, you have boroughs with a mix, and you have a lot of volunteers. So you can't really compare statewide how the fire services are delivered. And public works varies all over the place, as you'll see in another slide. It just varies all over. So police and administration really do work well to compare. Notice the change in the second-class townships. To me, that tells me they have a demand problem. Citizens are starting to expect police services. You hear a lot in the press, you hear a lot in the legislature about state police coverage, charging second-class townships for state police coverage. There's a reason. State police are getting more calls. There's more people demanding more services. A lot of townships have responded by hiring paid professional departments. As we go further in the presentation, you'll understand why when you hire your first uniformed policeman, you have now become on the road to a city and borough financial picture, and you're less the happy days of suburban townships. And nonetheless, there's a lot of pressure. First-class townships traditionally have had police departments, so you don't see a large growth there. They've traditionally had full services because of their location in your cities. So the most interesting thing of this study is that second-class townships are starting to look like full-service governments. And I like second-class townships. It's not a bad model. It's actually a very modern code. It's an interesting form of government, and they have a lot of development. But I think it proves our point that the structure is what causes the problems in Pennsylvania, and everyone is on the same train, just in a different car. What was the most interesting part of our Structuring Healthy Communities Part 1 report was what we call the five stages of municipal fiscal decline. When we first wrote this, we were worried that we were going to get sued by Kubler-Ross on the five stages of death, if you remember that book. But it's not unlike that. It's not dissimilar. Stage 1, we call low taxes with prosperity. That would be further out. I got to be careful. When I talk Lehigh Valley, I mix up Berks with Schuylkill and Carbon. I got to remember where I am. But you could remember some of these townships. The further out you get, when I was coming home from Lancaster yesterday, I went through Myerstown and I drove into Berks. You know the area. You know what you're driving through. It's wide open spaces. It's low taxes. It has a complex road network. Wide open spaces, so property taxes are taxed on large parcels. You don't have a denser population, and you generally have prosperity. You're hitting the towns with some money. There's local prosperity. There's a local indigenous industry, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's farm. But you know the type of that a municipality stage one represents. Low taxes with prosperity because there's very little demand. You don't have the population density. Next, you have people that say, I like this place with low taxes and prosperity. I'm going to move there. I think it's quaint when the horse truck with the corn husk passed me by. I want to move there. And someone decides to sell the farm after 100 years, and they get development. Eventually, that prosperity leads to development and attractiveness. Stage 2 becomes a situation where all of a sudden people that have moved there are starting to call for police. They're starting to call for road repair. They're starting to say, my storm sewer is backed up, or I don't like open culverts. I want storm sewers. My developer did this, and it only lasted 10 years. I want the township to fix it. And gradually, you get this buildup of demand for municipal services. And people have to pay for that through a system that's imposed by the state, and it's your taxes start to gradually rise. Notice I'm talking 30 to 50 years here. I'm not talking 5 to 10 years. That's why the look of 1970 to 2006 was so revealing. Stage 3, I think you might want to say that's a borough, a more prosperous borough, or a first-class township that has seen people moving by it. There's not a lot of development. Passing it, the new development, the further out you go, the nicer development, the more fashionable place to live. But those people have lived there. They now have a public works department. They now have a police department. They likely have a volunteer department that needs subsidies from the municipality. And the citizens don't like to pay taxes because the school district that was built to help them when they built there and they had the new schools, that school district needs some repair. And it also has some high expenses. And they're taxing the same base, the real estate base, the earned income tax base. All of a sudden, we don't want any more new taxes. We don't want any more property taxes. So what does the municipal leaders do? You cut services. And that's when you start to see core services, non-core services, I apologize. That's when you see a fee for garbage. When you used to have garbage picked up as part of your tax bill, all of a sudden you have a fee for garbage. When a pothole in the corner of two popular streets, we get the guy unelected at the next primary, he'd have opposition about that pothole. Now you have entire roads with potholes and washboard roads because you can't afford to constantly pave because you have this demand every time for the services that your citizens are demanding and you don't want to raise taxes. Finally, stage 4 comes in. Taxes simply don't pay the bill. Remember, 30% taxes in the cities. The rest is other sources of revenue. Reductions in core services. All of a sudden, you're paying for garbage. You're paying for a higher water fee. You know, you're paying for things that that you thought you were, should be getting as part of your tax bill, if you're getting them at all. And then finally, stage 5, which I since we wrote the report, we thought stage 5, there were some towns in stage 5. Honestly, since we wrote the report, we probably can't identify a whole lot of towns in stage 5. But stage 5 is a problem. You see it in other states. Stage 5 is close to municipal bankruptcy. You may consider it more of a South Bronx type thing. I don't think you see it as much. Maybe Philadelphia suburbs where you don't see cities, though, that are in stage 5. But stage 5 would be just people are leaving it. You have burned out buildings. You have blocks and blocks of nothing going on except problems. But as I said, that's 30 to 50 years. But we think it means that the municipalities in Pennsylvania are on the same life cycle because of this impositions from the state government of how you can pay for your municipalities. Pennsylvania severely limits the revenue you can raise by classification and by source. You're generally limited to property and earned income with a smattering of other taxes without regard to the local conditions. And we think that's very important. Now, to further buttress our argument that the second-class townships are part of a continuum, that it's a life cycle of municipalities, it's not genius of administration, it isn't incompetency, it's a life cycle, just like an older person is no more incompetent than a younger person, it's just older, more frail. You have stage 4 boroughs, 366. As I said, if we redid this today, you probably would see everybody in stage 4. But look at the numbers of boroughs. Cities are almost all in stage 5. We would call them stage 4 now. Look at boroughs, a large percentage. First-class townships, a relatively large percentage for that number. The surprising number is the second-class townships in stage 4 that met the criteria for stage 4. And that was a statistical measure, not a subjective measure. A lot of townships, when we wrote this report, were seeing the pressures of stage 4 and stage 3. A third of them were in stage 3. That's that leveling off part. That to us was surprising. The up-and-comers, stage 1 and stage 2, because of the large number of rural townships, that number probably won't change that much. There are a lot of rural areas in Pennsylvania, as you all know. You have the GI Bill. You have a pressure to move. Who knows if the economy today has reversed that? You know, you had the home ownership goal. You had the subsidy of roads. You had all that pressure to move out and not fix what we had. You know, you had that. But that itself is a 40-year trend. I had one of the first Main Street programs in the late 70s. I mean, this has been around for a while, trying to reverse this trend, and people are bucking it. They don't, you know, so it could be an escalation. I hope not. It gives us time to fix it. Now, what can be done with, we have obstacles. I've been trying to move forward in this slideshow to give you a hint to this. The obstacles on the current model, what your officials have to work with today, what is their obstacle? Why can't they fix this problem with their own resources? Typically in Pennsylvania, the property tax base doesn't go anywhere because it's a hot potato. Lehigh County, 1991, last reassessment. I think Northampton reassessed in 95. I'm not sure if they've done it since, but even in two counties that are very similar, you have dissimilar assessment policies. So when you don't reassess, you don't capture growth. If you don't capture growth, the tax base can only grow with real estate millage increases. And remember, no one likes millage increases. So what happens is you constrain your revenue. And that's an artificial constraint. If we had genuine assessment growth and equity, there would be a great pressure off municipals, and there would be a freeing up of some revenue from property tax value growth. We also have limits on real estate tax rates. We say cities, for whatever reason, can't levy more than 30 mils, 25 and 5. It's a code. It says you can't do that. No matter what your situation is, you can't exceed that. It doesn't consider service levels. It doesn't consider anything. It just says you cannot exceed those limits. Also, there are limits, statutory limits, on every municipality on earned income tax. No matter how wealthy your municipality is, no matter how much you want to shift from property taxes to an earned income tax, you are limited to 0.5%. By the way, the school district gets the other 0.5%. Now, my favorite story is if you looked at that model of how you distribute money, real estate tax dollar, 70 cents on average of your real estate tax dollar goes to a school district. 20%, 20 cents, roughly, maybe 25, depends on your area, goes to your county. The recorder of deeds, the proprietary, the sheriff, the county services. 20 to 25 cents goes to the county. Municipalities are fighting for 15 to 20%, 20 cents on a dollar. And I have yet to see, with that proportion of distribution, a school district police department, a school district public works department, a school district fire department, because our tax dollars seem to indicate that those entities should be providing the bulk of the services, and they're not. And also, school districts get 1/2 of all the taxes levied on earned income. Municipalities are limited by even that. They have to share it with their school district. Revenues that are at risk. Even though the model gives you things to tax, the market, the economy, might hurt you in other ways, in the sources. We all know that townships are living on earned income tax revenue. We saw it in the slides. But what happens if the economy goes south and all of a sudden stock options aren't worth a lot of money? And the people that move to your town that rely on their bonus, their benefit package, all of a sudden that dries up and you're no longer taxing that. And that happens relatively quickly, as we found out in the last few years. What happens if the housing, which will never happen, the housing market collapses and all of a sudden there's no homes being built? What happens to your real estate transfer revenue that you've lived on forever? If you remember our sources, real estate transfer is free money. Every time something changes hands, the town gets a piece of money. Every time someone gets a raise, the town gets a piece of money. What happens if those free monies start to go away? You have to raise taxes, and people don't like taxes being raised because the taxes are limited. So all you have to do is hire people. You don't elect the boob that's in there today. You go out to your polling place, and you make sure you hire, by voting, someone that is strong, right, Mayor? Someone that's got the guts to cut costs, right? That's all we need. We need new people to cut costs. Well, what happens when that person gets that job? They find out that public safety cost reduction is very, very hard to do. Pennsylvania has a law called Act 111, which guarantees binding arbitration to police and fire uniform people. It was a very good law when it was passed in 1969. It was much needed. Representative Friedman will give us the whole reason why we need it today. But it is basically controlling the contract negotiations out of the municipal's hands. They don't have much of a say. Minimum manning is common. You don't have the ability to reduce manning. People don't believe that, but you can literally not under some contracts, and I'm exaggerating, you cannot fire your way to a budget surplus. It's very difficult. So you cannot control those costs, which are the largest part of your budget, public safety. You also have a fixed size of the municipality. As your population shrinks, you don't shed streets. You don't shed sewer lines or storm sewers. You get the same municipality with less people and less money, but not less expenses. You also have a poorer and older population because that's all that could afford to live in your workforce housing. People that left your place to move into the bigger houses left behind housing, or grandma or mom stayed in the house, the family homestead, and the kids moved out. Someone buys those homes. Chances are they don't have a higher income than grandma or grandpa. Or they might be retired. They don't pay earned income tax at all. And then you have the legacy cost of employees. Pennsylvania has provided large-scale health care for retirees. There is a lowered retirement age in Pennsylvania for police, and people are living longer. And if you were a policeman or a cop, you're on your budget. I like to tell the story of a large northeastern city that collects $13.5 million a year in real estate taxes. It's a large city. It's as big as Allentown. It's not Allentown. It collects $13.5 million a year in real estate taxes. The health care costs for its employees is $14 million. Every single penny of real estate tax dollars that people complain about and write that check to and yell when they go to council meetings and scream about real estate taxes, every single penny goes to health care for employees. Not one penny for a pothole, not one penny for a car. And you cannot get, and in that particular city, there's 500 employees. There are 1,000 people on health care. So 1,000 people in a city of 80,000 people get the entire health care. I can go on. It gets annoying. But it's not the fault of the city. It's the system that we've put in place to deliver municipal services. What do you do? Ohio doesn't look so good. Virginia, not so bad. Maryland. But we're not going to move. We're going to stay in Pennsylvania. I think the biggest thing that I've said, and I think the Five Cities Group catalyzed this very well, it's a common problem. It's not us against them. It's not the wealthy against the poor. This is a continuum. We're all on this together. This is a system that has to be changed. How do you change the system in Pennsylvania? A radical idea is home rule. It was authorized by the Constitution. It said people that live in a town should be able to decide how they live in that town and govern themselves. Except the good government folks hijacked it way back in the 60s and said, we need efficiency and effectiveness and professional management. And it got that rap. Home rule has that rap for the last 30 years, that it really means people are going to come in and run our town. And locals like to run their own town. So home rule has gotten a bad rap. However, home rule has a very interesting option, and Mayor Panto ran on this option. You can stop charging state-level taxes. You can change your tax mix. You can get out from under those caps that we talked about. And if you do it right, you can shift the burden of taxes to match your population. Earned income, as you can see, is underutilized in its potential. It's capped. If you have wealthy people living in your town, you still can only tax them for 0.5% and have to charge their real estate. The citizens may want to pay higher earned income tax. I work in two Act 47 municipalities that the councils voted to have a 1.5% earned income tax to prevent a quadrupling of property taxes. As they improve their city, they have been asked by the Department of Community Affairs to Economic Development to get out of Act 47. To get out of Act 47, they have to raise property taxes and lower their earned income tax. The citizens are saying, no, keep our earned income tax high. We like it. And they have to now go through home rule to get that option. It doesn't make sense to me why the state doesn't allow locals to pick the level of earned income tax, except for the other problems that will all go towards employee benefits and not real services. Try to cooperate more fully with your neighbors. This is something that has to be done. It's hard to do. State law is very difficult. When the handouts will show you some of the things that are a problem in doing it. But it saves the service. It gets you out of that cut police to save budgets. It gets you out of the boundaries of your service area. It helps you pay for the service based on what you're delivering. There's no rational reason why a borough's boundary should define the size of its police department, because the demands of the citizens aren't defined by the boundaries. It's defined by the characteristics. So unless you cooperate and share services, you're not going to see an improvement in services under our current system. And really, when you ask citizens what a government does for them, citizens expect the police car. They don't care whose name is on it. That's been proven in survey after survey. They just want to know that a policeman is coming. They don't like it when they're told the state police will be there in 2 hours. They don't like it. The next steps, you need to organize and demand changes to state laws. It's being done. We'll talk about the legislation that's coming up and going down as quick as it's put up in Harrisburg. We need more flexibility. I think we'll ask Mayor Panto, Chairman Freeman, to discuss that. We need more flexibility in our ability to share services, in our ability to merge towns if towns want to merge or consolidate where a local agreement exists, where people want to do this instead of being mandated, because that just causes trouble. We need to look to sharing the resources. Resources mean a regional tax base. If you're a wealthy township, you don't like a regional tax base, but if you're forced to provide services in the future, you may want a regional tax base. You share a resource that saves the service, and that's what citizens want. There are some statewide efforts. One of them is headquartered here, the Renew Lehigh Valley and the Lehigh Valley Partnership. There are local groups. The Lehigh Valley was the genesis for last year's failed local option sales tax that went all the way to the legislature through the governor's budget message to give counties the power to levy a 1% sales tax. That started in Lehigh Valley 3 years ago with those groups and other interested people. Building One PA is a very interesting new coalition. Had a meeting in Lancaster a month ago. 600 people showed up from across Pennsylvania. People are very diverse audience, too. People are very worried about the probability of not having viable local governments. And local governments are critical to economic development and citizen services. I think that's it. Yay. Now, there are three bills before the legislature. Two are relatively controversial. One is horrid, puts people's hair on fire. The one is to wipe out local governments in service and bring it all to a county level, which is Kelta Jerome, which is the representative from Reading says he wants to start a conversation. The other one is allowing home rule to be part of a merger. It's kind of a techie thing and a wonky thing. And that would work with the recommendation to look at home rule and consolidate if you can, because the citizens, oftentimes mergers, while most people say too many fragmented governments, too many little towns in Pennsylvania, what they fail to realize is if you merge two towns, you have to pick a form of government. So if you merge a borough and a township, now you have to decide between a board of 7 or 9 councilmen with the mayor, or a board of 3 supervisors or 5 commissioners. All of a sudden, politics becomes real important. And savings not so important. You know, all of a sudden, who's going to have a position means something. And that's a real impediment. What Chairman Freeman is saying is that there's a way around that, but state law doesn't do it very easily. And it seems to be relatively supported. It's not such a deadly. You want to explain the one that was really, not the Kelta Jerome bill, the other one, the municipal boundary Senator Musto's bill?
The third one was proposed by the State Planning Board. The concept to create a boundary commission that would look at municipalities that were in severe distress, could no longer provide municipal services, unable to fund their services, and suggest to the legislature the possible merger or consolidation with a neighboring community in order to ensure essential services and a stable municipal government. That had mixed reviews before our committee when it was brought up. It's something that's probably going to be reintroduced in the next session. There's not many days left in this session of the legislature. But that looks at the idea of how you can find another path to taking those communities that are no longer able to provide for themselves and consolidate or merge them with another community in order to have a healthier community. That's going to be a subject of debate.
Thank you. Sure. Mayor Panton, do you want to elaborate? I guess we're almost out of time, right, Beta? Or is it we're okay? Would you want to elaborate on the home rule? Am I all wet on that? Because I've heard you speak on it.
What was said is absolutely true when it comes to structure. Cities, municipalities, not just cities, because I agree with Jerry that we're just further along. Township boroughs are where we are already, and townships are going to catch up. I look at a township like Palmer Township, had a lot of growth in the 60s and 70s and 80s. They're pretty much land-strapped now. They don't have a whole lot of growth left. So when you end up with growth and you don't have any more growth, then your taxes go up because there's no new money coming into your community. What Easton did was formed a charter commission We looked at the charter, at the form of government for home rule, and decided that home rule gave us the one thing that I think the state doesn't give us is flexibility. In our city, we were capped at everything. We had nowhere to go. Mayor Mittman already filed for early intervention plan. We had already done an update to the early intervention plan. And when I took office, I really thought we were going to Act 47. I think some communities are going to be bypassing Act 47, going right to Chapter 9. I think Harrisburg could be a good one for that. So the severity, I only point that out, not because I don't like Harrisburg. I know the mayor real well. She inherited a real mess, too. It's just where the status of cities are. Home rule gave us the flexibility, and we made a tough decision in 2008. We inherited about a $4 million deficit. We inherited about $1.5 million worth of health care funds that we just didn't have covered. And we saw no growth in real estate taxes. We're at 25 mils. We can play with that a little bit. As you know, we can put 3 mils towards recreation, put the debt service towards that, and we really only have 20 mils. So we could have gone up 5 mils, but that's just playing games. So what we did was we made a concerted effort. We put up real estate, earned income tax. Put up earned income tax for one reason. It was a seniors' budget. Seniors who aren't working were not affected. None of their costs went up. Those who are working paid 0.75 cents per $100, per dollar rather, per $10, I'm sorry, 0.75. And so a person who was making $50,000 a year instead of paying $500 for it was paying $750. So we really looked at it as a way of saying, let's go after the people who still have something. And that's the whole basis for the optional sales tax. And I know Representative Freeman does a phenomenal job. He chairs our local government committee out in Harrisburg. And the reality there is that if you look at the reason why state taxes don't have to go up as much, they're tied to economic stratus, income and sales. So as income and sales go up because the economy goes up, there's normal growth. But if you're tied to an assessment that's now 20 years old, you have no new growth. There's no automatic increase in your budget. Now, in a good day, our decision to go to earned income tax would have been very, very good because we would have gone and said, okay, normal rate of increase in earned income tax is about 2 to 3%, depending on the economy. Unfortunately, we're seeing a loss of earned income tax. We just did our mid-year budget review and decreased that by $200,000, and we know we're going to have to decrease that by another $200,000 by the end of the year because of unemployment or underemployment. A lot of people going back to work, but they're not making what they were making. So when you look at the cities, we can talk all about should you pay more if you live here. For all the professors that teach at the college, they all have a great salary. They don't live in Easton. So their money goes with them to wherever they live. And so there's the issue, the local service taxes, which was a big help, was $10 for 50 years. I mean, it wasn't worth sending out the bill. So we went to a home rule charter under Bob's leadership, and it received resounding success. I don't think any of us thought the charter was going to pass the way it did.
You didn't hide the fact it was a tax increase.
No, we never said that. Matter of fact, we were kind of labeling ourselves the taxing commission, because the administration was saying, we want to go home rule to raise taxes. And we said, no, that's not why we're going home rule. We put a lot of good professionalism in it, a lot of transparency, and I think the city is better for it, not just from a revenue point of view, which we are the only city that ended up with a surplus again this year, compared to the other two cities. Most people tell me they're amazed that Easton is on better financial footing now than Allentown or Bethlehem. And that's not really true. It's just that it's from an individual point of view. Last year, the only reason we brought in a surplus is because we underspent the budget by $1.3 million. Had we just said, okay, staff, just do what you have to do, spend your money, and Gretchen's here and Becky's here, then we would have been $1.3 million short. So budgets are very much like business. Every day and every month, like you said, payroll to payroll, we meet every month to go over our finances. What are our numbers looking like? And then you start making adjustments. And we had to start cutting back our adjustments last year, keeping positions open to make sure you come in at the end of the year in the black. And if you don't care about that, we would have been $1.3 million in a hole instead of a whopping 39,000 to the good. The mayor's back here also from Whitehall.
Oh, yeah, let's see the mayor. What's the borough say?
Just want to touch on one quick point because I think it's adds another dimension to the issue. And it's an excellent presentation. I've seen you do this before on other venues. Part of the success of Easton, too, is we have an excellent mayor in Sal Panto who's done a great job of professionalizing City Hall and doing the kind of budgeting needs to be done in a very thoughtful way. But another dimension to this problem, which really needs greater attention, and I actually introduced legislation last session to try and deal with this, and we're going to reintroduce it in the next session, is the issue of tax-exempt properties. That exacerbates the problem for a lot of older urban core communities. We did some studies before we introduced my legislation, and if you look at the number of communities that are falling into distressed status in Pennsylvania, going Act 47, the vast majority are either boroughs or cities that have an exceptionally high percentage of tax-exempt property. Now, those tax-exempt properties play a vital role within a region. They're often colleges or universities, non-for-profit medical facilities, or county government centers and complexes. Easton has all three. So you can imagine, actually two. We don't have the medical. That was in Wilson, of course. But that can be a tremendous drain on, or a loss, rather, of revenue to be able to meet your essential services. It's almost like trying to fight your municipal battles to provide services with one hand tied behind your back. If you look at the communities that are in distress, in large part it's because they don't have the tax base anymore. Tax ratables have been replaced with tax-exempt properties. And look at the cities that are in distress. Harrisburg, 48% of their total assessed value is tax-exempt. Johnstown, which has been Act 47 for a number of years, 48% is tax-exempt. Here in the city of Easton, 27%. And the mayor and I have talked about this before. It's probably a higher figure because a lot of those buildings, particularly at the college, are probably undervalued into their assessed value. So it's probably more like a third to 40% of the total assessed value of property is tax-exempt. When you have that higher percentage, you have a shrunken tax base from which you cannot provide the necessary revenues to keep services going. You can negotiate that in Pennsylvania, but you can't mandate in lieu of tax payment under current law. What I offered as a proposal back in last session, and we'll reintroduce in the next session, is that we take a state-dedicated funding source. In this case, the 18% Johnstown flood tax that is levied on the sale of every bottle of wine or liquor sold. That was initially put in place in the 1930s to relieve the victims of the Johnstown flood. We had success with that. They've been relieved, but the money's still rolling in. It's about $250 million a year that comes in from that tax. And my legislation would take that tax, dedicate it to a tax-exempt municipal assistance fund, driving those dollars back into any community that had 15% or more of its assessed value as tax-exempt. So the higher tax-exempt communities would realize money from that revenue source. And the logic is as follows. Those tax-exempt properties, by and large, have a regional mission, or even a statewide mission. If it's a college, if it's a county government center, if it's a medical facility, their mission and their impact is way beyond the municipal boundary. And yet it's the municipality that has to shoulder all the burden of providing the services without getting any revenue because they're tax-exempt. If you establish a revenue source that can be shared, such as the Johnstown flood tax money, you then recognize that these communities deserve to be compensated for housing all the tax-exempt institutions that we value, recognize have an important role in our society, but don't pay taxes. So it's a way of being fair and giving compensation to those communities that have been saddled with a shrunken tax base, and we're hoping to reintroduce that in the next session.
What happens to that money now?
Currently, it goes to the general fund. Given all the funding shortfalls every state's experiencing in the current revenue picture, that's been used to keep other essential state programs going. So the likelihood... Well, when I first introduced it, we had surpluses, and that's why that was an ideal way of shifting that. As the economy reduced revenues for everyone in terms of sales tax revenue, income tax revenue, that money obviously has been needed for the general fund. As we come out of the recession, though, I'm hoping we can make the case again that that's a good use for that dedicated funding source. At $250 million, I forget what we looked at what Easton could get, but it was about, was it $1.8
million?
Yeah, almost $2 million in revenue to assist in their budget and their needs. And again, it's based on a very sound principle, and that is that these tax-exempt entities are, by and large, a regional asset or a statewide asset. Let's make sure that we compensate those communities that have to house them and don't get the tax revenue from it. So. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on.
One of the things that you have to realize is the political dynamic is that someone will run for someone against council and say, well, they're not making the hospital pay its fair share. I will. Or I'll make them, I'm the mayor, I'll go get the nonprofits to pay their fair share. Trouble is, there was a report done addressing that issue about 4 years ago by the state, and they showed that the hospitals that are remaining in cities don't have the money to move out. So it's really hard for if they had the money, they would have moved out already. As you witness St. Joe's and Burke's, and a lot, you see that argument all over. I think it's here too. You move to the township as opposed to staying local, and the weaker institutions are the ones that are staying behind, and they're the ones that are least likely to be able to pay money. So it becomes a whole, you're wrapped up in the whole structure thing. But well, if the performance of local governments is municipal services and the provision of clean and safe habitat for their citizens, then the logic is you give them a venue to play in, and that venue has to have revenue. It has to have gate emissions, whether you play professionally or not. If you play by yourself, it's a very cheap performance. If you're playing to an audience, well, maybe it isn't. Depends on your I said that wrong, didn't I? But my point is, once you get people that rely on revenue to be able to do the performance, you're stuck. And as the audience's ability to pay gets less and less, the shared part comes in, I think. And that's where the shared revenue comes in. The trouble is, in Pennsylvania, we have defined these things with these solid borders that you don't dare tax Fountain Hill if you're in Easton. You don't dare tax Wilson Township, Wilson Borough, right? Borough. You don't dare share those revenues because where I live, it's my money going to my services. That's why the economy in the last 10 years, you know, we've been tagged for years as saying they just want to consolidate municipalities away. About 10 years ago, we kind of changed our emphasis, and we sum it up a little bit. Some people argue with this, some don't. I think we used it at your hearing. We don't believe there's too many small governments, but there are too many service providers. Absolutely. There's too many service providers, and ergo, there's too many taps on that revenue that you need to provide those services. Citizens are happy, I think, with consolidated services, and they're not happy with the solo policeman who's the chief in a force of one. It just doesn't work, you know. But that's our history, and I don't know how you break away from the past history, saying there's too many small governments, and people looking past what governments are supposed to give them, which is the service level. It's irrelevant who's providing it. Fair enough. I mean, taxes are, they're okay. I mean, they pay for a service. It's the question of how much and who's paying for what service. Right now, we have a very spotty service delivery system in Pennsylvania, and it's unfair to the people that live there. In a sense, it's a fraud on your taxpayer when you're paying for a service you're not getting. For example, the city with a medical bill for employees higher than the real estate taxes. There's something wrong with that picture.
Any other questions or comments, Marlene? Yeah.
I have to ask because I don't quite understand how this thing works. You're talking about more local government control, but then if the services need to be regionalized, then what's the matter with the county doing it? We're talking about a bi-county health board. Why wouldn't you just put maybe not government, I don't know, you know, little local community problems could be handled very small local level, but have services handled on a county level. But you said that's a bad...
The problem with comparing Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, with Montgomery County, Maryland, where if you remember the sniper that went around, there was one police chief that talked. If you remember the news coverage, that was a Montgomery County police chief. In Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, there's 20, 30 police chiefs. So if there was that kind of crisis, You couldn't bring together a unified voice because counties in Pennsylvania exist to register your birth, your death, your marriage, your property transactions, and what you if you got in trouble with the law. There's not a whole lot. Well, it's okay. But it's a different form of government. Our county government right now today, the county could not provide a police force. It's against the rules. You'd have to change the law to provide wide scale. They could be a facilitator, but the county commissioners rely on the same tax base, and they don't have an earned income base. It's complicated, but you just can't say, let's bring everything to the county level tomorrow. It's evolving. That was my point, Mayor, that the counties aren't the ideal place to just level. But ultimately, a solution would be regional service delivery that's broad enough to have economies of scale. two towns sharing a police department solves the problem perhaps for that town, but it doesn't get to the wholesale sharing for the county. But Pennsylvania's counties don't live like Montgomery County, Maryland counties. They have a different purpose. It's a different form of government in Pennsylvania. Our office has done a lot of police regionalization studies, a lot, and they do hinge on one thing. It's almost predictable. You can show minor savings or maybe small upfront costs because it's a professionalized force or whatever, and gradually decreasing costs over time. You could show that, but you cannot get through to the fact that someone says, my town has three cops now, and if I join with two other towns, we'll have 10 cops, but there won't be cops in my town. They'll be patrolling elsewhere. They don't. You can't get past that first thought that you want your own cops. They would. You just can't get. And you could almost predict it. Someone will stand up and say, "But tomorrow, I'll pay more in taxes if we can keep our own cops." And the meeting falls apart, and the regionalization dies. And
how can we create the objective political pressure for politicians to actually deliver on this stuff? Do you have an idea of what kind of, maybe what's worked in other states or places? That's the question.
It's a good one. I don't know if I have a complete answer, to tell you the truth. Part of it is educating the public, which is one of the purposes of this forum. You're right, drawing on other examples in other states can be a great guide to see what Pennsylvania might be able to do, but always keep in mind that every state is a different political culture, and the application of a great idea in a different political culture can have different results. So you have to be mindful of that as well. I think one of the most frustrating things that I've experienced in recent years, and I'm sure Mayor Panto has too, is that we've seen a shift in terms of engaging the public. And I don't mean to beat up on the news media, but I've seen in my lifetime a shift from news reporting, which was informative, things citizens should know about, things citizens should hear about, to just, well, we're only going to report stuff that's sexy. You know, a major crime, anything controversial that'll kind of hype the news is what makes it into the front page, what makes it into the evening news. And so we now are losing the kind of forums for ideas and civic engagement that the newspapers and the media used to be an essential ingredient in that process. Sal and I served on the Home Rule Charter Commission. We had a really good reporter from the Express Times who showed up a couple of times and gave us some good stories. But the vast majority of the local media never attended our meetings. And once we got, God help us, once we got into the nitty-gritty of talking about how you structure the new form of government and got into the dry-as-dust details of doing that, no one was in the room except for us, even though we were actually determining the structure and the future of that government. People didn't engage. So I think part of the problem is how you reach people, how you engage them. In a society where attention spans are shorter, where we're constantly hyping and constantly jumping to the next bit of anxiety rush, the next scandal, the next hot story, the next what Snooki's doing, for God's sake. All of those things seem to gobble up too much of our attention. And as a result, the public realm suffers and civic engagement suffers as a part of that. And I don't know how you deal with that in a pop culture-driven society, but that, I think, is one of the problems. If you cannot even get to the first level of civic engagement, civic involvement, to have proper discourse, to set a course for your society, where do you go? So it's a tough one, but it's a good question.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. And thank you, John, for that closing question. I think it was really an appropriate way to wrap up the discussion. On that point, I want to close because we're out of time, but at Reduly High Valley, one of the things that we really focus on is trying to, in the absence, as Representative Freeman said, of some of the local media coverage, we try to do as much as we can to take these issues and this discussion out to the community. Along those lines, just to apologize for the microphone setup, we do record these and we make them available online for download and also via iTunes. So we'll be getting word out to you about how you can forward this so that people who couldn't be here today for this discussion can access this this conversation. Thank you all for being here today. I appreciate the comments and the discussion. I thought was very productive. As we move forward, Reduly High Valley looks forward to continuing to do outreach and education and community engagement on this issue, and also to keep you apprised of what's going on in Harrisburg, because a lot of these, as has been made clear, wind up being about the policy issues and the policy debates that are happening at the state level. So thanks again for everyone for being here. I want to thank Jerry Cross, of course, for his remarks, and thank Beta Bajalska of the Renew LV team for all her work on the event. The other thing I just want to just finally mention, I neglected to say earlier, is that the League of Cities is doing a task force to look at these issues and make recommendations for state policy. I'm glad to say the Lehigh Valley is very well represented on that. Mayor Panto is a member. Mayor Pawlowski is a member of that task force. We also, Jerry, who's a friend of ours, is facilitating the task force. And Bill Hansel from Lehigh County Commission is also involved with that. So we're very fortunate to have that moving forward, and we'll continue to keep you apprised of the progress of that group as it goes forward. Thanks for being here today, and I appreciate your interest, and have a great weekend.